From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is continuing to push his proposed tariffs on aluminum and steel to punish China. But as has been pointed out, U.S. allies like Canada and Brazil will also be hurt. This morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan tried to be a speed bump.
What we're encouraging the administration to do is to focus on what is clearly a legitimate problem and to be more surgical in its approach so that we can go after the true abusers without creating any kind of unintended consequences or collateral damage.
Also today, a visit from the Swedish Prime Minister. Perhaps being a Swede, he can help negotiate this, but he's spending the afternoon with President Trump. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there. I don't quite get the Swedish reference, but maybe you'll fill me in.
They're nice. And, you know, as we've noted this week, the president's call for tariffs should not be a surprise to Ryan or anyone. Candidate Trump pledged them. But the president also said Sunday he'd slap a tax on foreign cars. BMW built hundreds of thousands of them with American workers in South Carolina. How else might the president's thinking affect the American workers he says he stands for?
Well, certainly if you work for something like U.S. Steel or an aluminum manufacturer, then it certainly might help. But when it comes to everyone else who depends on that raw material, it's likely to hurt. So if you think about manufacturers in the pipeline, equipment manufacturers, for example, the oil industry, they are upset about this and very concerned. Those are traditional Republican conservative business interest groups and not used to dealing with a president who's a Republican who tries to go this route. They would normally think that somebody like a Bernie Sanders, a protectionist liberal, would try something like this potentially, and this is not where they were hoping that this president would go. But you know, it shouldn't be that surprising. He's been saying this kind of stuff for 30 years, and he takes this kind of broad brush approach. But it's one of the downsides to sort of playing checkers, this one-on-one deals he wants to make, as opposed to understanding the broader economy and the need to play chess.
Well, Ryan's office also said the speaker is afraid, as many Republicans are, that the tariff could erode gains made by the Republican tax cut. But meanwhile, to the Swedish Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, he's here, and Electrolux, which is based in Sweden, announced last week that company will delay a $250 million plant expansion in Tennessee because of the tariffs. Other countries have threatened to retaliate with their own tariffs against Harley-Davidson and Levi jeans. So Trump says he would win a trade war, but do you think a face-to-face meeting with a European ally might make a difference?
Well, you know, Trump famously likes to listen to the last person he talked to, but we'll see when it comes to this. They're supposed to be talking about military readiness and how the two countries can still cooperate. But certainly the economics of tariffs and trade as well as Brexit have to be at the top of the list because there's certainly some uncertainty in Europe right now in its relationship with the United States.
And I just want to ask quickly about South Korea's meeting with North Korea, trying to open dialogue with the U.S. The president tweeted today that for the first time in many years, a serious effort is being made by all parties concerned. The world is watching, waiting, maybe false hope. But the U.S. is ready to go hard in either direction. Just thoughts on what that might mean if there are talks.
Well, the president tweeted about it today, seemed open to it. He didn't talk about Little Rocket Man or anything like that. The one thing to look at, though, is I was thinking about who would be the negotiators here, because a lot of this spate work is usually done by experts in the State Department, and a lot of the Korea experts have quit and aren't with the State Department anymore. Yeah. So you really wonder what the negotiations could look like and how delicate this is. You want those experts with you.
That is serious business, but we do have the Swedes here today. Look, I have to ask you about Sam Nunberg. Elsewhere in the show, we take a deeper dive. This former Trump aide who went on, you know, TV insisting he won't respond to a subpoena from Robert Mueller to provide emails. Phil Rucker from The Washington Post told us elsewhere in the show, this isn't unhinged. This is who he is. What do you make of it?
Well, he's a provocative guy. He's somebody who's, you know, his mentor is Roger Stone, and we know that he sees himself as sort of a provocateur, trickster type. You know, it's notable that Nunberg, after his full Nunberg that he pulled yesterday, sort of reversed course and said that he will cooperate with Mueller.
Yeah. I got to ask you, too, about Kellyanne Conway. The Office of Special Counsel is recommending disciplinary action against her. Remember, she went on TV on the White House lawn telling people not to vote for Doug Jones in Alabama. That violated the act that limits political activity by federal employees. That's a problem.
Well, normally you're not supposed to talk politics, and the office put out guidance again saying that as the president is running for re-election, to remind people not to do that on federal ground or on near a federal building. Mm-hmm. But the White House is being defiant, and they disagree with the findings.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And teachers have reached a deal in West Virginia. State lawmakers announced today they'll raise pay by 5% for all state employees, including teachers that had been striking for 9 consecutive school days. Classes should be back in session tomorrow. Kevin Green teaches social studies at Riverview High School in McDowell County, West Virginia, and he joins us now from the state capitol in Charleston. Kevin, your reaction to news that this deal's been reached?
Well, I think my reaction is the same as that of the rest of my colleagues. We are quite excited that a deal has been reached, and I think we're ready to go back to the classroom.
As you know, a lot of this has been about the salary that West Virginia teachers make, the average salary, about $45,000. You are among the lowest paid educators in the United States. A 5% raise, maybe you're going to get a little over $2,000 more on average. Is that enough to make a difference?
Here's the deal. This movement, and that's what it is, it's really a movement. It's more than just about money. It's been about a quality health insurance. It's been about protecting our public schools from things like charter schools and voucher programs and protecting our ability to deduct union dues. So when you look at everything that we've gotten, we have a promise to fix our health insurance, to keep it reasonable. You know, our public school system is protected because we don't have to worry anymore about, or at the moment, about charter schools and voucher programs. And we are still able to protect our, or have our union dues deducted from our paychecks, as we always have, and we can have strong labor unions. As far as pay, you know, this will not put us much farther up the list, but it does show that the legislature has heard our cries and has agreed to give what they feel is financially sound at this moment. And we have to accept that faith and continue working in the future to increase our pay to a level that is competitive with the surrounding states.
This fight over the last 24 hours or so had come down to a single percentage point. The Senate went back on its deal that it had made with the governor for a 5% raise and countered with a 4% raise. You know, the argument being that the state of West Virginia couldn't afford the difference. Even after this deal has been made, there will be people out there who say the state still can't afford that extra money. What do you say to that?
I understand that argument. However, the governor and then the House of Delegates examined the budget, and they came to consensus that there was money for the full 5%. They determined that the money was there, so we have to trust them in that, because they're the ones that see the numbers on the paper.
This is the 9th school day of a highly publicized strike. I understand that you were a part of a group of teachers that helped deliver lunch to some kids who normally would have been fed at school during those days. What is the impact on families and students throughout the course of these 9 days?
Well, we understand the effect this has had on everyone has been tremendous. We know that. And I am, in addition to being a high school teacher, I am the president of AFT McDowell.
And you're talking about the union at your school?
Well, in my district, yes.
Okay.
And one of the things we wanted to do was help ensure that our students who needed or relied on school meals 5 days a week, we wanted to make sure that they had food to take home or to take home with them during this time.
What did parents tell you about the hardships they went through over the course of those 9 days?
I'll be honest with you. I've spent all of my 9 days here in the Capitol, but what I've seen from my people on the ground at their individual picket sites is we've had parents and community members bring us food, actually, and show us their support, and they told us just to keep fighting and keep waiting it out.
This was a 9-day strike. Do you think that the students who weren't in school lost any ground academically?
You know, we have time to recover lost instructional time. So really what we've done is we've just, in essence, we have shifted our instructional days down the calendar. So in the grand scheme of things, I don't believe that our students have lost ground in their instruction. And I know that many teachers have worked, you know, behind the scenes through our online gradebook and communication systems with our students. They've worked to kind of provide assistance for any instruction that may have been missed. I know a lot of teachers sent home work to be completed over the break, and they provided the assistance as they were able.
That's Kevin Green. He's a social studies teacher at a West Virginia high school. Kevin, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
One of the most highly anticipated movies of the spring opens this Friday. A Wrinkle in Time stars Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, and Storm Reid as the heroine, Meg Murray. Meg is a bit of a problem child. She's struggling with the disappearance of her scientist father, but with the help of three mysterious beings, she goes on a journey to look for him. Her little brother and a schoolmate come along as they travel to faraway planets where creatures speak strange languages.
Can you help us find him, please?
I can't tell what they're saying.
I can. They speak color.
Before it was a film, A Wrinkle in Time was a much-loved children's book by Madeline L'Engle. Margaret Willison is here to help us take a look at the legacy of that book. She's a librarian, a culture writer, and a frequent guest on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Margaret, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's go back to 1962, when this book was published more than 50 years ago now. It was rejected by 26 publishers before somebody picked it up. Why?
Well, because they had no idea how to categorize this book. It's dealing with kind of advanced theoretical physics ideas. It's written for a young audience, and it stars a girl. And publishers just had no idea how it would work. And Madeline L'Engle famously said, adults can't understand it, but children absolutely can. Her kids would sit and listen to her tell the story night after night, and they loved it, and they wanted more of it. And the science stuff that's so daunting for an adult brain, they just took on faith and could wrap their head around these very complicated ideas.
You mentioned the character, of course. The main character is
Meg
a girl.
Meg Murray.
The author is a woman. I mean, it was 1962.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a significant portion of the fact that it wouldn't get picked
up? That was a huge, huge issue. She was really one of the first female leads in a science fiction narrative ever. And people just did not think you could sell a hard sci-fi story with a 14-year-old girl at the center.
Tell us about Meg Murray. She is so smart. She can do math equations like in her head like that.
Well, she's very smart, but in a way that a rigid school system is very, very poorly designed to recognize. Mm-hmm. So she is, in fact, extremely smart and extremely advanced, but she goes to school and she feels dumb and she's getting terrible grades and she's honestly in danger of being kept back. Huh. Because her mathematical stuff is so advanced that her teachers don't know how to get her to do math at the level of her classmates. And conversely, she cannot bring herself to care about anything that is not math or science. The humanities stuff, memorizing the major exports of Nicaragua or the location of Pakistan, holds absolutely no interest for her, and she can't retain that information at all.
So here's Meg, who is intelligent but has problems at school. But there's something else going on there. She also would not be considered pretty by her classmates.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons the book endures so much is because Meg is one of the few outcasts in children's literature that actually struggles with the stuff kids who are isolated from their peers struggle with. Part of that is the fact that she's just sincerely homely. But the other part of that is that she's so incredibly vulnerable. Hmm. Where other kids can kind of keep their feelings in and control themselves, Meg is just this open nerve, this beating heart of feelings, emotions, protectiveness. And so I think it's really meaningful to see a kid struggle with this quality that 14-year-olds, like,
you know,
nothing
it.
Is
yeah.
worse.
You know that feeling.
Yeah. yeah. And throughout the entire book, she doesn't really seem special. Her little brother is incredibly special. He's a telepath. He's a genius. But Meg just seems kind of normal and awkward. Mm-hmm. And what you learn at the end is that it's actually this thing that holds her back so much in life, this inability to keep her compassion to herself, to keep her feelings contained.
Yeah.
That's what lets her save the world.
Do you remember reading this book as a girl?
Yes, absolutely. I
remember
reading
it.
I loved it. I'm also named Margaret, so I had a certain egotistical boost to share the name with the main character.
You could relate.
I could relate. But it's a really transporting adventure.
I want to talk to you more about the era again that it was written in. I think this is important.
Mm-hmm.
1962, the middle of the Cold War.
Yeah.
and I bring that up because it matters in the book. I mean, there is an allegory buried there somewhere.
Absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where reading it as a child, it doesn't register at all. The same way you wouldn't notice that Aslan is a Jesus figure in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Mm, it's by C.S. Lewis, who was a Christian writer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in this, when you're a child and you visit the alien evil planet of Kamazots, you notice this conformity that is absolutely universal among all of the people there. But it hits you at a much more grade school kind of level where when you're 10, you're 11, you're finally reckoning with how socially important it is to be like everyone else and how absolutely impossible it is to be like everyone else. So you just put it into those terms. But when you read it with an adult eye and you think about 1962 and you think about the Cold War, especially the way that society is organized in Kamazots, where no one has any individuality and everyone is tapped into a sort of collective mindset.
A statement against communism, essentially.
Yes, it is a very anti-communist narrative.
Yeah. Do you think it'll translate into modern times in a film?
Yes, I think it will, because the issue of conformity versus individuality, even separated from a Cold War metaphor, still has so much resonance. And the visual idea of conformity is so strong and easy to convey.
Mm. Now, as you know, whenever a film is made on a book from childhood, you're going to have legions of fans who had a vision of what their favorite characters looked like in their heads from that time, right? Well, something interesting is happening in this film because it is a multiracial cast and Meg comes from a biracial family. How do you think people will respond to that aspect of this?
I may be in a privileged circle, but I've seen primarily extreme excitement about the fact that this story that's been such a touchstone for so many people for so many generations is broadening its horizons and making some of the stigma that Meg faces in the book, grounding it a little bit more in stigma that real children are facing today, fighting back against racism, fighting back against stigma of biracial relationships and all of that kind of stuff. It's giving some of her outsider status even more weight in today's society than it would have had naturally. And the complete imagining that Ava DuVernay is bringing to the story.
The director, right.
Is so thorough and so beautiful and so well thought out that even if she's creating a world that's a little bit distinct from what you might have gotten on the page in Madeline L'Engle, it's so cohesive and it has such a perfection of vision that I think people are really ready to be transported by it.
Yeah. A Wrinkle in Time opens this weekend in theaters. And we've been speaking with librarian and culture writer Margaret Willison. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Well, what's going on in Turkey, an important U.S. ally that's been shifting towards Russia, straining already frayed ties with the U.S. as Turkey continues to fight the U.S.-backed Kurds in northern Syria? Despite falling foreign investment in Turkey, the country continues to promote itself as a thriving economy with rising potential. NPR's Peter Kenyon has this look at what's going on.
Glowing economic headlines appear almost daily in the Turkish press. A recent one says, foreign investment hits nearly $11 billion in 2017. It's only if you click on the story and read on down that you discover what actually happened to foreign investment in 2017 is a nearly 20% slide from the previous year. Kush Çokci with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was in Turkey recently to see what can be done about one of the country's economic problems, chronically low American trade with Turkey compared with Europe.
We would like to change that. The bilateral relationship is about $20 billion in overall trade, and that just can be significantly improved.
An optimist by profession, Chuksi says technology, e-commerce, and healthcare are all promising sectors, and maybe even construction as well.
If there were rebuilding associated with Syria one day, Turkey would be a huge base for that and would also provide opportunities in the construction area, possibly for Turkish and American companies to cooperate.
But plummeting Turkey-U.S. ties are not helping. In Washington, there are calls to impose sanctions against Turkey for a host of reasons, including the jailing of American citizens and consular workers, a scheme to evade U.S. sanctions against Iran, and Turkey's pending purchase of Russian missiles that can't be integrated with NATO systems. And then there are Turkey's ongoing military attacks against Kurdish forces in Syria who are supported by the U.S. Economist Attila Yeşilada says that hasn't hit Turkish markets yet, but even the threat of heavy U.S. sanctions could change that quickly.
If these become public, if United States leaks its intention to punish Turkey to the press, then there would be a market shock which would spread to the economy.
There are some very positive indicators. Turkey's growth this year is estimated at a healthy 4%. It has a strategic location, a thriving startup culture, and a very business-friendly government. But Yeşilada says those bright spots are clouded by the state of Turkey's democracy. A broad crackdown with tens of thousands of arrests since a failed coup in 2016 has given foreign investors pause.
The state of emergency, which was absolutely necessary to deal with the coup, has been around for too long. The rule of law no longer applies. Due process has been abolished, to be perfectly honest with you. And the arbitrary confiscations of Turkish companies, even though no foreign company has ever been touched in Turkey, obviously raises concerns.
For now, unemployment is falling, though it's still high. Tourists are coming back, but they're spending less. As people here scan the positive economic headlines, concern about where the Turkish economy is heading refuses to go away. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
So now you know what's going on in Turkey.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The Senate begins debate today on a bill that would weaken the Dodd-Frank banking regulations passed after the housing collapse and financial crisis. One of the things the bill would change is the so-called Volcker Rule, named after former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. And the current Federal Reserve Board is also considering changing that rule. So let's remember what that is. With Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. And Ali, start with the overall bill that the Senate's considering to roll back parts of Dodd-Frank. Remind us, you know, what it was supposed to do and what the changes would do.
Yeah, Robin, good to talk to you. The whole bill was meant to sort of prevent banks from doing all sorts of risky things that could affect the economy as a whole. And there have been a lot of complaints over the year, mostly from banks, but from others who say that it's been a little too restrictive. So the core of this new bill is going to exempt about two dozen financial companies that have assets of between $50 billion and $250 billion from the highest level of scrutiny by the Federal Reserve. So there are three parts to watch in this bill. The effect that it has on community banks, bills with fewer than $10 billion in assets, they would be exempt from something called the Volcker Rule. Mid-sized banks would get less scrutiny. And the biggest banks, the biggest change there is that the Fed will not enforce rules on them equally and across the board. They'll be able to tailor it to each bank, which the banks like, by the way. They didn't like the fact that they all had to follow the same rules.
Well, the Dodd-Frank law had near unanimous Democratic support when it passed 8 years ago, and now 12 Democratic lawmakers are sponsoring this bill. So what's changed?
So the Dodd-Frank rule, again, which made sense at the time, was to prevent banks from doing risky things with money that people had deposited on them, because, as you know, the banks had been trading that stuff, and then the trading asset-locked
values. And
right.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So these were rules to keep everything a little tighter. Now, even Barney Frank of Dodd-Frank said that he would have been open to changes. There are some concerns, though, that taking restrictions off of banks up to $250 billion in size could be dangerous, because if four of those banks went out of business at the same time, could that be as big as serious as a big bank going out of business? So Barney Frank thinks the $250 billion limit is too high. It should be $100 billion. But there are senators in a few states where Donald Trump won. They're Democratic senators. They've been targeted by the financial industry for donations, and they are trying to appear more moderate. So that's why there's Democratic support.
Well, but isn't there still fear in some quarters? We remember the Volcker Rule. It pretty much kept commercial banks from using it. This is customer deposits.
Customer deposits, correct. Speculative
trades, you know, cutting up mortgages. Oops, they don't work and everything. And this was after the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed after the huge, you know, crash of 1929,
yes,
which separated commercial banking from investing. It used to be they just kept your money in banks, and then
yes,
Wall Street did the investments. Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999 under
yes,
Clinton, and some said that led to all this risky stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't there a concern we'll just go back there?
Yes, that's exactly the concern. So while there are some who say that there can be changes to the Volcker Rule and to Dodd-Frank to make it not so onerous, particularly on the smallest of banks, that, you know, they're basically, community banks are really struggling under this. The fear is if you deregulate too much, banks do have a tendency to get themselves into the sort of trouble that they did. Even the Volcker Rule didn't say banks can't trade anything. They just can't trade more than their customers right, might need to take out.
So they're just doing a Goldilocks thing.
Yeah.
Trying to see if they can find
yeah,
a sweet spot.
Yeah, yeah.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, also co-host of Velshi and Rule, and our friend. Thank you.
My pleasure.
A charity to honor Philando Castile says it has paid off the school lunch debt for hundreds of kids in Minnesota. Castile was killed by a police officer during a traffic stop in 2016. Today, students at St. Paul Public Schools, where Castile worked, remember him as Mr. Phil, the lunch supervisor who helped pay for their school lunches out of his own pocket when they couldn't afford to. Pam Fergus teaches psychology at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. She launched a button campaign to remember Castile, but after meeting his mother, took up the lunch money cause. She started the charity Philando Feeds the Children. Pam, welcome to Here and Now. And $150,000 you raised, were you expecting that much?
Never. When we first started this fund, and thank you, I'm happy to be here. When we first started this fund, I presented this as a little project to my diversity and ethics class, and we were going to try to raise $5,000 to pay off just the lunch debt at the school where Philando Castile was the lunchroom supervisor. And I thought, $5,000 in 4 months, you know, how can we possibly do this? And at the end of that 4 months, we had $104,000, and we had a lot of schools letting us know that they would like some help. So, yeah, total just amazement. It was.
Let's be clear about your relationship here. You did not know Philando Castile. You did not know his family. You were a teacher at Metropolitan State University.
Right. I didn't. When he was killed, I was shocked. You know, most people know that his girlfriend in the car live streamed that via her phone to Facebook, and I couldn't stand to, you know, watch him die. And then was angry, but was really convinced. I'd convinced myself that a year later, when it went to court and that police officer was charged with murder, I thought, you know, here's the one case where justice can happen, because there's a dash cam video. You can see him being very calm and very still and not reaching for anything. And then you see the utter panic of that police officer. And I thought, here's the thing. This is going to turn the tide in this country, you know, finally. And then he was acquitted. My life was changed that day. This was a guy who worked in education. And I felt some
like
kind
you.
Of connection.
Yeah, like you.
Yeah, like me, yeah.
And you stood up. You stood up and you did something. I want to know what you learned about Philando Castile, the man in this project, who you only really got to know, I imagine, after his death.
Exactly. You know, I think I really got to know him because his mother loves to talk about him. I mean, when I called her on the Sunday where I thought of this fundraising for food debt. We were on the phone for probably 3 or 4 hours, and she was just telling me stories. She sent me photos of him as a little boy. You know, it was obvious that he was just a regular guy. You know, he was just like anybody else.
A regular guy who would occasionally dip into his own pockets to help children pay for school lunch. Now, let's talk right. about what your charity is doing. It's wiping out the debt for kids who cannot pay for lunch at school, which in and of itself is something worth talking about. What can you tell us about that?
Well, when I found out from Valerie that Philando hated when kids didn't have the money and they'd be given a different lunch from everybody else, and how embarrassing that was, and that he could just imagine himself stuck in that same place, and he couldn't do it. So, you know, his pocket, $3, $3, you know, every time a kid couldn't pay. I just thought, well, that's a nice way to honor him is by continuing to pull $3 out of a pocket somewhere, you know, to help pay for school lunch.
How does it get to be, though, that a kid can't pay for school? There are government programs, lunch subsidy programs, that will
right.
pay for a kid's lunch if you can't afford it.
Exactly. And the paperwork that parents have to do to find out whether they qualify is very off-putting. It's, you know, it looks like government forms, and that can be scary for some parents who maybe are new to this country or something. And the naysayers who find their way back to me and basically say, you know, these parents, they have to find a way to pay. We're just enabling them or whatever. And we just think, you know, it comes down to, does that kid have a meal in front of them at the lunch table? Mm. And it doesn't matter why a parent can't pay. You know, maybe it is just the paperwork is so hard, but maybe I think for the majority of them, they simply don't make enough money.
And the debt, though, belongs to the school. So your money that you're
right.
raising is going to the school.
Right. And it will pay off the food and the food vendors. Otherwise, they get paid somehow. You know, it might come out of the arts or the music budget or, you know, somewhere. So, you know, it's the connection between providing a good education and paying for lunch.
That's Pam Fergus, who started the charity Philando Feeds the Children. Pam, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
And let's take a look now at Amazon, which is reportedly looking into getting into the business of banking. According to the Wall Street Journal, the online retail giant is talking with JP Morgan Chase and other firms about building a type of checking account that would appeal to younger customers. Here and now, tech correspondent Ben Brock Johnson is here. Ben, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Amazon checking account, what would that look like?
Yeah, so far, there are not a lot of details. We don't really know what this will look like because Amazon is not commenting. Neither are the financial institutions it's reportedly talking to, JP Morgan Chase and Capital One. Presumably, this would work kind of like any other checking account, you know, possibly. You'd be able to store your money there. You might be able to pay your bills through it, might be able to write a check, for instance, as well as be able, of course, to shop on Amazon. Not a lot of clarity on whether you can shop elsewhere necessarily. It's also unclear if ATMs would be part of this. You know, Amazon is talking to these banks reportedly, again, according to the Wall Street Journal, but it might be possible to draw cash through ATMs that they are using.
Yeah, and it sounds like Amazon is really going after the younger customer there. We know that young people have a much different relationship with banks than older generations do. What's the thinking?
Yeah, so recent data from the FDIC says that about 7% of U.S. households are unbanked. We're talking about people who are young, as you say, also people who are lower income, for instance. In terms of younger people, it is relatively common these days to not have the same kinds of accounts as older generations. A lot of people don't even have a retirement account. There are a range of services like PayPal and Venmo. I mean, I use Venmo all the time. I don't know if you do.
I don't, but I feel outdated for not doing so.
well, people are doing a lot of this kind of stuff. And, you know, Amazon is trying to tap into that. And so are some of these financial institutions and sort of get a piece of that pie.
Yeah. So Amazon would also, I know, be able to waive some fees, which would help the bottom line for the company. But here, I think, is the key issue. data.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if Amazon can get you to open a checking account, it has so much more information, and it already has a ton about us.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what's really interesting about this, I think, and a little bit scary, too, to be honest. You know, your kind of older financial institutions, you might go into a financial planner and say, hey, I want to save my money, I want to buy a house, something like that. And presumably, they would advise you without a lot of incentives necessarily to buy their own products, whereas Amazon is going to get a ton of information potentially from these people in terms of when their paycheck comes in, what they spend money on right after their paycheck comes in. And Amazon is thinking about how to market this stuff to people ever more effectively. And so you might see some of your behavior as a checking account holder be leveraged against you to market things to you as an Amazon user.
Every time Amazon jumps into one of these new industries, I'm thinking insurance, pharmaceuticals, delivery, stocks in those sectors inevitably drop immediately. Why would banks want to get involved with Amazon?
Yeah, so some of the early analysis of this story is that this isn't actually as big of a threat to banks as previously was thought, in part because there's a partnership potentially happening here. J.P. Morgan Chase, for instance, you know, I think also wants a piece of that data that Amazon is so effectively getting. And, you know, I think that generally speaking, these companies probably do better when they work together to understand your data. And since some of the younger customers who are already moving away from traditional banking might be attractive to J.P. Morgan Chase, for instance, as well, I think there's kind of a natural fit there potentially.
Here Now Tech correspondent Ben Brock Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has made it a priority to roll back government regulations on everything from the environment to the internet. One of the laws now targeted for reform has been called the most impactful law nobody's ever heard of. It's called the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA, a set of regulations that encourages banks to invest in low-income communities. CRA has been law for 40 years now. Brian Watt from member station KQED visited Fruitvale Village, a development in Oakland, to try to measure how the CRA has been working there.
I'm standing right near the Fruitvale BART station, and I've brought an old map of the area with me. It's from August of 1937. There were maps like these for neighborhoods and cities all across the country, and this one comes with a list of the favorable influences in Fruitvale and the detrimental influences. Here's what it said was bad about the Fruitvale neighborhood. Odors from industries, predominance of foreign inhabitants, infiltration of Negroes and Orientals.
You know, whenever I read this language, I stay speechless, right? That the government would have had policies such as this that so disadvantage people by the basis of race and occupational status and these other factors.
That's Carolina Reed, professor of city planning at UC Berkeley. And that's right, a government agency made those maps. They were actually part of an effort to increase loans to people in cities to help recover from the Great Depression. Some areas were considered good investments, and some, like this one around Fruitvale, were ranked as bad investments. The bad areas were colored red on the maps. It's where we get the term redlining.
So these neighborhoods outside of Fruitvale Village and Fruitvale in general were redlined in the 1950s and 60s, which means that these neighborhoods were denied access to credit because the federal government refused to guarantee mortgages and other loans that were being made in these neighborhoods.
In the 1960s, as protests raged about a lot of issues, redlining was one of them.
There were activists in Chicago who saw that banks in their community were refusing to lend and invest in those community members and in those community assets. And so they really pushed on the banks and a senator named William Proxmire to say, if we want to stem urban disinvestment, if we really want to undo the negative effects of redlining, we need the banks to put in investments and loans in these same places.
In response, the Community Reinvestment Act was passed in 1977. Part of what it does is encourage banks to work with local community groups to find opportunities for loans or investments in services that can actually help a struggling community. And that's where this guy comes in.
My name is Chris Iglesias, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Unity Council, which is a 53-year-old community development corporation.
The nonprofit Unity Council worked with banks to invest in a development called Fruitvale Village when it was first built in 2004. In exchange for their investments, banks got credit for complying with the Community Reinvestment Act.
You know, it wasn't necessarily out of the goodness of their heart, but I think this is became a much more viable option for them under this program. And you know, we've taken advantage of that.
Now, Fruitvale Village is a development with 47 units of housing, restaurants, small businesses, and a bank branch. And the investments from banks didn't just help build this place. They helped the Unity Council fund community services like a health clinic, job training, and Head Start. Sylvia Guzman's three kids came through this Head Start program. She serves on the board of the Unity Council and educates other parents in the neighborhood.
This is my ground. This is my roots. And this is where my children played. And this is where my children get their education and their services are met. And I shouldn't have to go elsewhere if I have that at home.
So for people like Sylvia Guzman and places like Fruitvale, the Community Reinvestment Act has made a difference. But it's not perfect. The Bay Area is struggling with an epic shortage of affordable housing, and housing advocates say that banks can and should be doing more to help. Kevin Stein with the California Reinvestment Coalition has some ideas.
Perhaps do more work with nonprofits who can buy buildings that are at risk of being flipped due to market pressures, so that people who've been living in the Bay Area for a long time can continue to live in the Bay Area. Because when people get evicted, as you know, it's very hard for them to find places to go.
Stein's coalition is watching to see what changes to the law the Trump administration will propose any day now.
We're expecting that there'll be efforts to dilute and weaken CRA and its impact on the community, and we're getting ready to fight that.
And while they get ready, back in Oakland, phase two of the Fruitvale Village project is now under construction. This time, there's a major focus on affordable housing. Out of 275 rental units, 94 will be affordable family homes. 20 will be reserved for formerly homeless veterans. Another investment in a community that still desperately needs it. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Watt in Oakland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.